I'm David Halpin. You've heard me before, Tony. I'm retired orthopedic and trauma surgeon, so I've seen quite a bit. And I have, since my full retirement, over the last, I suppose, 15 years at least, yes, longer, I've been focusing especially on our NHS, on Palestine primarily, and on Dr. David Kelly. I suppose I'm the lead person, Lee Kelly, because I looked at the pathology quite a lot. I was good on pathology as a student and as a young doctor, and I've always kept an interest in all branches of medicine. But pathology is absolutely vital for any doctor. If you don't know how things go wrong in the human body and in the mammalian body, then you're not much good at diagnosing disease. If you have good pathology in your brain and you're interested in what mechanisms disturb our healthy functioning, then you have no x-ray eyes into the patient when they come to you. But I have had x-ray eyes because of my pathology and my other medical knowledge, of course. So, I've now in my 84th year, my birthday is on the 14th of April, and I am not giving up. My dear wife of 62 years, who I married as a nurse when I was 21, is not so well at present. She's had to have a cataract removed, tumour from her right forearm, which I relate to having one of the AstraZeneca jabs, just one, against my advice, I add. And she also had trouble with balance and backache. So poor Sue suffers quite a lot. I have to do a lot for her now. She is aware of that, and she's a bit sad that I have to do so much. But I don't mind that. I love cooking, and I love caring for people. I've just seen a man today, an ex-Royal Marine. I'm going to write him up in one of my Continuum of Fascism articles. He's dying of a mesothelioma. That's due to blue asbestos, which he came into contact with as a Royal Marine on a frigate. I'm going to write that up. This is typical of what's going on in our world. And I notice that the doctors caring for him are blurring the diagnosis to try and save £130,000 payoff, which they're now giving out to Royal Naval veterans who suffered similarly.
Yeah, I suppose the medical
was known about before the Second World War.
The medical profession, I suppose it's like many professions, journalism included, which is open to pressure, financial, political pressure, for doctors, for example, to have pressure put on them by the pharmaceutical industry to prescribe a drug which may deal with a symptom, but as you were talking about pathology, not really addressing the causes of an illness.
Exactly. And the thing is that I'm well aware, I've become more aware, having made a very good friend, Joe Clark Irons, a professional gardener, contact me about 3 years ago via my website because of her. She has Palestine and they're suffering in her heart. And with her, I've been able to look back more carefully at what has happened to me. And there's no question that I've been under surveillance for a long time by the people we pay our taxes for. And that when I was at Torbay Hospital, I was actually being targeted. Things were being made awkward for me. And in fact, when I retired unwisely, I should add that I was encouraged to retire when I met the medical director, who was supposedly a friend. He's on the right wing, so-called, and my erstwhile colleague, Mackay. They asked me to meet me at Torbay Hospital in, I think, the director's office. And I was still then in the early phases of recovering, or in the early phase of being treated, for a severe physical and mental breakdown due mostly to the lack of thyroid hormone, which wasn't diagnosed by the NHS for about 4 or 5 months anyway. It should have been diagnosed on day one when I had my breakdown in February 1992. And it was also probably a reflection of the fact that I was fighting like hell for the health service, for our hospital, the Princess Elizabeth in Exeter. It's 120 beds and the best esprit de corps you could imagine. We fought as surgeons against its closure, and eventually the fascists bulldozed it in 1996. So now there's only in Exeter about 35 beds available for orthopedic surgery. The there's now 33 surgeons, where there were about six, and you can imagine how often operations are cancelled and how the surgeons are always jostling to try and get patients.
You might well find that there's some developer has now built on top of that hospital. Maybe what's there now?
Well, what has happened to the, it was very interesting, the whole thing, actually. I know the history of it pretty well. Veitch, the V-E-I-T-C-H, was a wonderful nurseryman from Scotland, from Edinburgh. He came to Exeter in about 1875, something around that time. He set up a wonderful nursery there of 80 acres. And the Veitch's house was at the center of the hospital. It was part of the nurse's home, I seem to remember. There were trees there, Wellingtonia from his time. And you can imagine, with the new permanent way of Brunel, another wonderful man, people would come far and wide from England, from across England, to view the plants in Veitch's nursery. The hospital was established there in 1996, about 1926, by a general surgeon called Dybal. He knew the need for orthopedic surgery for little ones. There was a lot of deformity from tuberculosis and things like clubfoot, things like that. Polio, another cause for deformity. And the fact was that general surgery focused on the elderly, just as orthopedics does now, really. They were more interested in the giddies from the adults. So children's surgery was rather neglected. But that man, Dybal, must have had a different brain. I don't know enough about him. But it was opened by the princess when she was 11. And it was a wonderful hospital where I trained mostly. I started there in 1970, and I finished 5 years later, one year in Truro, 6 months over in Massachusetts General on a research fellowship. I became a consultant in 1975. But this is the important thing. In 1988, the ultra-fascist Thatcher, with her Center for Policy Studies, I think the chairman was our friend Keith Joseph, they produced the internal market idea. It came from from Milton Friedman, head of the Chicago School, and they all believed that private was good, public was bad, and the way to dismantle public services was to starve them of funds and to, with propaganda, portray them as failing. The health service was being set up to fail by people like Milton Friedman. And a man called Professor Enthoven flew across to advise Thatcher. He was from the Rand Corporation.
Oh, right.
And you will know the Rand Corporation was about killing, set up in 1947, mostly about war.
Well, look, it's fascinating because this internal market was that what they used in the 1980s and early 90s at the BBC as well in order to do that.
But the thing is that this is the key thing. They knew these people, the people pro-corporation, pro-capital, pro-fascism, they knew that if they could kill the NHS, which was, you know, world known as a socialized medical system, if they could kill that, they would be delighted, and they would know that the other green bottles would fall one by one. But it hasn't, and the NHS is being rebuilt, because within it, I just, last week, Sue had the most wonderful care in our NHS by very, very good specialists. And they are there waiting to go on working. And it is being rebuilt in spite of the most ghastly politicians of each colour. Tweedledum, Tweedledee, and Tweedle.
Yeah, well, I call them the A-team and the B-team. The BBC, they called it Producer Choice. So this was how they sold it in 1980. I think it was about 88, 89.
I remember that now. But just think that I spoke against Thatcher's internal market from Torbay. I was the only voice, as far as I know, among about 75 consultants. Mm. I spoke out publicly and vehemently against this first stroke to kill the health service. It was a nonsense, economically, in the costs of running the health service, and I knew this, and I raised it right from the word go, the cost of administering the health service doubled in some hospitals in 1 year, from 5% to about 10% of total budget, and in some hospitals, about 15%. and all the titles, you know, everything was changed. New monikers, more people, more desks, more chiefs, less Indians, and an effect to, in my alliterative liking, they wanted to destabilize, demoralize, and dismantle. So when I retired, very improperly encouraged when I was still here, I could have been either with a lawyer or not even being interviewed. I should have been interviewed when I'd recovered, about 2 years later. When I was encouraged to retire, which I did, I had my pension was fixed then by the NHS, and it was enhanced by 6% for what they called industrial injury. So what was the targeting of me was acknowledged by the system in my pension.
So we're going to be talking about the King. It's difficult. I still think of him as Prince Charles, I suppose because of his what happened in the 1990s with his dear wife, if we can call her, dear to us, not necessarily to him, Diana. But
well,
let's just...
She was a good human being.
Well, she was an absolute...
She was a good human being.
Yeah, a fantastic woman.
She had a tender heart.
But the trouble is she hooked up with the Al-Fayed family who, for decades, had set themselves about destroying the British establishment. This is Mohammed Al-Fayed's goal through funding various things like the Scallywag magazine in London, the Punch magazine. These were places that journalists came to. I mean, for example, Simon Regan, who'd been working on The Sun as an investigative journalist and who was elbowed out by Rupert Murdoch when he took it over. So there were these various kind of homeless journalists wandering around London, all coalescing around Al-Fayed over the decades.
And this is
one of the reasons, of course, why the idea of her hooking up and being pregnant with a child from Dodi Al-Fayed would have been a bit of a difficult thing for the establishment. But anyway, let's not dwell on that. That's maybe for another time. But because the King has been diagnosed with cancer this week, hasn't he, David?
Yes. Well, I heard that he was going into a London hospital because he had the prostate problem. And I imagine that he had what we call prostatic hyperplasia. That means excess growth. It doesn't imply cancer. And the commonest cause is benign hyperplasia. And this causes men to get up at night with pee, have more difficulty peeing, the stream lessens. Instead of being able to hit the wall with your stream, it tends to dribble. And you get dribbling at the end of the stream as well. You can diagnose that from the history, and then you do the next thing. You ask the patient, having told them what you're going to do, of course, to lie upon the couch with their knees flexed up by their chest, and you put your finger inside a latex glove with some KY jelly into the rectum. You can then feel the prostate in the front of the rectum. You can feel the prostate quite easily. It's a very important examination. There was a little saying that if you don't put your finger in, you put your foot in it. And that when you put your finger in, you can feel the prostate through the wall of the rectum. And if it's round and smooth, you know it's likely to be benign. If it's craggy, then it's more likely to be cancer. And prostate cancer is an odd thing. There's a whole range of them, from what we call cancer in situ, where it's just a few cells scattered in the tissue, to when the whole organ is, in fact, has become cancerous or is being invaded more widely. But so, we would imagine that King Charles III, if he was being looked after by a decent doctor, but they might have been a bit tentative, perhaps, about putting their finger into the queen, into the king's rectum, but we will imagine that when he presented with his urinary difficulty, he then had a rectal examination, per rectal examination, his prostate. They'd also examine his penis, his testicles, and they'd do a general examination if they're proper doctors. They examine his tummy, and after taking a first-class history, tell me, sir, I know what you say, tell me, sir, what's troubling you? And you'd hear the whole history, and this is very important, Tony, that gives you the diagnosis in two-thirds of cases without examining the patient. So, going back to examination after the good history, we might have established that the King Charles III had benign prosthetic hyperplasia. And that the prostate was enlarged, and his symptoms were severe enough to progress towards a cystoscopy, examination of the bladder with a cystoscope, and whilst under anaesthetic, although you don't require that for cystoscopy, you can use local anaesthetic gel. Whilst under anaesthetic, you would examine the prostate again in the operating theatre, I believe. I did a very good urology job in Southgate Hospital in Bristol, in the best urology firm in the country, where Mitchell, one of the surgeons, had invented the resectoscope, which I'm now going to speak about. If the King's symptoms were significant enough to require removal of the enlarged prostate, then they would have inserted Mitchell's resectoscope, or a modern equivalent, with an extra powerful light made by Storz, and using a high-frequency radio signal through the little loop at the end of the resectoscope, which burns the tissue in a very local way, then the surgeon then takes out chips with the resectoscope and gradually removes the prostate in its mass via the urethra, via the penis. You understand? Every now and again, you take the scope out and you flush out the chips from the bladder, and you go back in until you've removed as much tissue as is required. It's a skilled operation, a very skilled operation, but modern urologists will be very familiar with it. And when I go back to 1967, when I was working at Southmead with Mr. Slade and Roberts and Mitchell and Ashton Miller, another leader in Bristol, those men used to come in with retention of urine. They couldn't pee at all. They had to catheterize them. Now and again, some of them were very constipated. Most of them just had benign prostatic hyperplasia. As a junior doctor, we'd put in the catheter under sterile precautions. They go to the next operating list. They'd have an anaesthetic, an epidural anaesthetic by a wonderfully skilled anaesthetist there. I can remember their names now. And one of those surgeons would resect the prostate in those old chaps. And they'd be going home about 4 days later from a ward which was entirely devoted to urology of men and women. And that was what used to happen. We don't know what happens now so well. But going back to the King, we then heard that he'd had an operation on his prostate, I believe, and that it was benign. I think we were told that as well. But then there was news that he had a separate problem, a cancer that wasn't in the prostate. Now, you've told me your one possibility, that it's in fact a story for a purpose. But what I thought about was this. It is being reported that the so-called vaccines is untried toxic junk administered to about 5 billion people globally, willing to have themselves injected without any informed consent, which is against our ethical base and against the Nuremberg principles of regarding experimentation on humans. They had these injections. In this country, it was mostly AstraZeneca, Oxford, but that was withdrawn, as you know, in May of 2021 because of the distinct incidence of pulmonary embolus from clots in the veins. But it's been reported since that the turbo cancers are being reported, especially in the colon and rectum. And I wondered whether Charles III had been injected with the junk. and I'm told it was highly likely because he was very, very keen on vaccination. You might say because he was a good friend of Professor Schwab et al., Gates et al. So what I'm wondering about is whether the king has got a rectal cancer, like our dear daughter died with in May of last year. She had symptoms of colon problem in April. She told her mum that she was passing feces like rabbit pellets, rabbity feces. And Sue advised Fiona to go to her doctor. She went to her doctor. They found blood, I think, in the fecal smear. And the doctor, with her finger, a very good GP, found a mass in her rectum. That was in April, I think. No, a bit later, May, I think. She was then referred to a surgeon at Yeovil, and she had incipient obstruction of her colon by rectal cancer in July. So there was only 2 months between the symptoms and the narrowing of her bowel in the rectum. It was then a pinhole. It was so tight, the exit from her colon through her rectum, that she was obstructing. Her belly was blown up. She was getting colicky pain. And after 6 days, the surgeons did an emergency colostomy. And the surgeon, when he spoke to me, just forget his name now, it's an Ashkenazi name, actually, he's a nice man. He came in at lunch to speak to Sue and me, and to Fiona and her partner. And when he said, when he put the laparoscope in to do the colostomy, he could not find hardly any large bowel which didn't have secondary cancer plastered on it. So Fiona, age 56, our dear adopted daughter, died on May the 5th of last year. Her final hours when Sue and I were with her were pretty terrifying for her and very distressing for us. She was what we call hypercatabolic. The tumor in her liver and in her lungs and in her belly were eating up her muscles. Her muscles were so weak she couldn't stand. But for all the time, she kept her morale. She always had a joke, and she was brave right to the end. But Fiona had a turbo cancer. And we now got two friends who have colonic cancer.
Can I just ask about the jab? Did Fiona have that?
Fiona had two jabs. She had been a carer supervisor for 9 years. The firms were, I think, sold over twice. You know, these firms often run. I can go into that, these care firms. But she did mostly night duty, and she also had a tetraplegic fellow who was injured badly in a road accident. He had no spinal cord below about T4, had a tracheostomy, and she was his carer in the night hours in a private capacity. She was paid separately for that. But she was also a carer for a care firm and a supervisor. She had to make sure that when a carer couldn't turn up because her husband was ill or something, she found someone else to go to her lady's house. So she dealt with all that and the bureaucracy. Each person who has care in this country has to have a care plan. And you know, she told me it was 120 pages. So that was what she did. For 9 years, she was good at it. She looked after my dear sister, Mary, when she had a cancer taken from her thyroid in 2014. Long story there, but she went up with Sue when Mary came out of hospital, and she cared for Mary for 10 days. And Mary, who's sadly suffering from some dementia, poor memory, short-term memory, Mary always speaks lovingly of how Fiona looked after her. So Fiona, after 9 years, had a break. She couldn't always sleep easily because she was concerned when she went to bed that someone might turn up and say he couldn't look after someone. So when she used to stay here, I found that one night I went into her bedroom in our little annex, and she said, I said, you're still awake, for you. She says, I can't sleep, Dad, because I'm always a bit anxious at night, and it seems to persist. She had about 18 months off doing other things, not earning much at all, actually. And then she thought, I'd better go back to caring. So because it was mandated, the bloody stuff, she had two injections of AstraZeneca.
Oh, dear.
One in February 21 and one in May of 21.
So she would have been sacked if she hadn't had those jabs?
She'd have been what?
Sacked if she hadn't had those jabs, would she?
No, she wouldn't have been able to get a job. She would have to go back to a care firm. In fact, I was encouraging her because she left the last firm. She had a disagreement with them, actually. It was a bureaucratic nonsense. I can remember some details. Good example of what's going on. They're treating people, as I say, the whole plan is for global serfdom. This firm was based in Salisbury, eventually, the one that bought over the previous one. She was living in Sherborne with her partner, the house that we helped her buy, and she had to drive to Salisbury, I think every fortnight, for a meeting. They're good on meetings, as you know. It didn't pay her petrol. It didn't pay any hours when she was going up and down to Salisbury. And I think there was, I forget what happened now, but she put her foot down. She was a pretty bright girl, actually, and she was a very logical person. And she was a very good carer, no doubt. She had a very good heart. But she didn't get a reference when she left. And I said it was a silly thing not to have had. So she had no reference. But she would have had to go back to intercare. She went back to caring, she would have had to have had vaccinations in that part of 2021. Hence, two injections.
Very
now, she knew,
tragic,
I think the family knew that Dad was against it.
Hmm.
But I'm afraid that the cell phone and texting and the rest of it, what I call the electronic noise, I think Dad's view, although he is a very experienced doctor and surgeon, who thinks a lot about things and is wary about the world and the people running it, I think they tended to put aside my views.
Well, as I understand it, in the care world, it was mandatory.
It was mandatory.
Whereas in the National Health Service, there was a very strong group of NHS workers that held out, and they said, "No, we are refusing to have these jabs."
Well,
and if you want to sack us, and then at the 11th hour, would it have been? I think April in 2022, the government backed down. They said, "Oh well, actually."
But a lot of people had it there because, you see, particularly ones in the lower wage levels, people like nurses, you see, they're living on their own subsistence incomes, effectively. You know, who the hell could run a mortgage on 24?
Well, I know. I mean, it's basically a threat of eviction, isn't it? Say, have a jab or we're going to evict you. Anyway, let's get back to the King, because I want to get a little bit of an insight from you, if possible. Let's just assume, because certainly my view is that both the King and Camilla will not have had the jab. Prince Philip and the Queen did, believing that it was going to do them some good, and that obviously, you know, that may have precipitated their deaths. But I don't. I mean, I see most definitely see Charles and Camilla as insiders. It's very interesting. The Times printed a fascinating article saying effectively that Camilla wears the trousers. Also pointing out that several people that got New Year's honours quite clearly got those through pressure from Camilla, not through Charles. But an honour is exactly as John Lennon, you know, rejected it, because these things are now used as. For a kind of sycophantic status rather than anything else, which is why we've got the very first ever Labour leader, very first ever Labour potential Prime Minister, who is also a Sir. You know, so this is what they do: is they use these honour system as a kind of sycophantic thing. But anyway, I just want
to possess them.
I wonder if you could. I mean, you've already had a go at speculating what in the examinations that King Charles had. Due to his prostate problem, which apparently wasn't cancer, what cancer he may have if he does have it?
Well, I've postulated one that you would have expected the surgeon treating him to have examined his prostate properly per rectum and in doing that, he would have detected a rectal cancer. But we don't know what his symptoms are. We haven't examined him, so I cannot.
Well, they're saying absolutely nothing. So, what would the treatment regime for that be?
What for?
For rectal cancer, yeah.
For rectal cancer, it is in fact a cascade, really. If it was could be excised, he would have an operation called an abdominoperineal resection. It's a rather radical operation. I don't get into the gory details actually, but the rectum is removed with the tissues around it, which would include the lymph nodes, and that is done. They may have more modern methods of dealing with it actually now, but that was the operation for a rectal cancer, which you could excise with some prospect of removing the tumor and any spread into lymph nodes. When it's past that, then you might try radiotherapy, not knowing whether it's sensitive to radiotherapy or not, but you will also have to consider doing a colostomy, like Fiona had. So that's if the king has a rectal cancer, which should have been evident in any examination for prostate trouble. Mm. So that postulation of mine is weak, to be blunt about it. We don't know. There's all sorts of other cancers. I have to add, too, actually, that rectal cancer can be associated with other things other than having had the COVID vaccine. There are virus infections of rectal tissue, which I think can lead to cancer as well. We won't discuss that. Mm. It's rather morbid and rather personal, as you might imagine.
I mean, the other possibility, surely, is that actually he does have prostate cancer, and the whole idea of saying beforehand that it wasn't cancerous, this is just a sort of admission that maybe it was.
It's what?
Is it not possible that maybe it is prostate cancer and that the attempt to say that it wasn't is now being sort of swept aside? He's being very unspecific about it, aren't they?
What I'd say, Tony, there is that, you know, they're feeding populist ideas mostly, and of course we had all the people, the psychopaths, talking about his empathy and what have you, in spite of his lack of empathy for my Palestinian sisters and brothers. But it would be popular to say that he had prostate cancer because it's a very common cancer. The incidence is rising all the time. I wondered, as you probably know, phosphorus ion is associated with prostate secretions. And I wondered whether the nuclear tests, 100 something like 1,200 I think altogether, atmospheric tests, you know, post-Second World War, and, of course, the actual explosions in Hiroshima and Nagasaki haven't, in fact, caused some isotope of phosphorus to be widely distributed and is a factor in the increasing incidence now of prostate cancer. I would have said that if he had prostate cancer diagnosed with the resectoscope, you know, with the chips being taken out, examined in a laboratory, put into wax, and then sliced, examined under the mic, stained, and then the cells looked at. If he had prostate cancer, then they would have been very happy to say it, because it's a common cancer, and there's a lot can be done now to save people for many years from dying of prostate cancer. Not always. Some don't. Some die. It's a rather unpleasant cancer in its own way. It goes to bone quite a lot. But I think that the group around him, the PR people, would have been quite happy to say the king had prostate cancer.
You may well be right. So, fascinating.
50,000 people.
I know. Well, I mean, the thing is that the idea is we're not supposed to speculate, but of course people do speculate, and they will speculate. Everyone around the country will speculate. So there's a kind of farcical attempt to kind of keep a lid on these things.
Yes.
Look, you talked there about, you know, the examination and the way that the medical staff will take him through the, you know, asking him about all of his various, you know, medical conditions, history, that sort of thing.
Yes.
And of course, there is a psychological sort of side to all of this. So it's quite important to get some sort of an insight. If you look at the man, what we've seen a few times over the last year or so is, I mean, for example, there was the incident where he was at his coronation and he was sat in the coach. In a very, very grumpy manner. There was somebody who is able to sight read, you know, what his lip read, that's what they call it.
Yes.
Saying that he was saying it is so boring, this always happens, these kinds of things. He sounds like a very, very sort of impatient, grumpy chap. And then there was the incident of signing, there was a signing where there was a camera there and caught him in a very grumpy mood, saying someone always messes things up, and it just seems like a kind of grumpy chap that blames everybody else. There's also the fact, he's known. I mean, there's a very good Novara Media video saying that this guy should not be king because of these reasons. And one of them is the way that he doesn't accept any kind of difference to his own opinion. This was a homeopath doctor that was brought in.
Oh yes, Dr. Ernst.
Yeah,
and
Dr. Ernst said, "Oh well, I'll do a very, you know, very good comprehensive test to prove that homeopathy is incredibly effective and wonderful, and that maybe we can get treatment on the NHS for it." And unfortunately, his series of tests proved nothing of the sort, and ended up showing that actually homeopathy was ineffective.
Yes.
And because of this, King Charles then got him sacked from his job in the hospital. So he was adamant.
Yes,
that
right?
Yeah, that's...
He was local, you see, he was in Exeter, that fiction. Yeah.
So he was manoeuvred out of his role anyway. So he actually says is that Charles will not accept anybody whose opinion differs in even the smallest way from his own. So this is a sort of chap he is. And,
monarchical, you mean?
Well, I mean, it's almost like having a medieval monarch in charge,
yes, exactly.
Really.
That's what I'm saying.
Whereas the Queen was very different. She saw her job as a kind of overseer of these things, and let's let them get on with it kind of thing.
Yes.
So I'm you know, a bit concerned about whether or not he is just looking for ways to stop doing these, you know, boring, troublesome duties that he doesn't like doing, spending more time doing what he wants to do, which is flying around the world, saving the planet from climate change and this kind of thing. He's obviously very much more political. And, of course, this allows him not only to garner massive sympathy from the public. I'm not even convinced that he does have cancer, David. This is what I'm saying. And the other angle to it, of course, is that, so not only is he garnering public sympathy, he's saying to William, look, you go and do all those boring things that I don't like. It's over to you now, William. You can get on with that. And this has given me a perfect excuse to do what I want to do rather than to do my public duties.
What you're saying is that he wants to be, although he's grumpy, he wants to be political. He wants to be able to have his association with Schwab et al. And to follow the climate change nonsense to the nth degree. Yes.
Yeah, I just wonder, is it possible that the whole thing is just PR?
I can see that there is some logic in your analysis, actually, particularly because of his very strong... Well, first of all, I'd like to say that he made... the most stupid friendships, as he did with Saville. That picture somewhere of Saville shaking hands with him in the bother he had in Glen Lomond, where he was Glen Lomond. Things like that, you know, to find...
Yeah, there's lots and lots of photos of the two of them having a right laugh together with Saville. But the thing that really... you know, amazed me. I can't use the word shocked. I just am not shocked anymore by almost anything, I'm afraid. Is including the fact that potentially there is no real... I mean, the cancer story is knocking Gaza off the headlines. It's on all the time now. And it is the fact that he actually commissioned Jimmy Savile to write the entire public relations program for the royal family. So Jimmy Savile is the author. I don't know if it's, I mean, maybe they've revised it since, I do hope so. But why would you choose somebody like Savile to say, well, this is what the royal family should be doing in regards to public relations? So the entire public relations machine of the family was written by Savile.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
but I do know that Savile met, I suppose, about 20, 30 years ago now, the president of so-called Israel, and advised the president that they weren't being tough enough on the Palestinians. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that, no.
And in fact, it is said that Jimmy had the relevant genes, but we'll leave that aside. But I do know he did speak with the president of Israel, and that was his advice. It was in a Wikipedia article.
Yeah, because I think the thing I like about you know, your analysis, David, is you're not, because if you're interested in pathology, you're also looking at the psychology of the individual, not just the presenting illness.
Well, the thing is that there's something they're cranky anyway. Generally, if you grow up in an environment where everyone looks at you, and you're being photographed from every spot over the palace walls and what have you. I was asked to attend. He was riding his mother's horse. This is about 1990, I should think. I was still consultant then at Torbay, and my gynecology colleague McPherson was, I suppose, you know, medical officer, something like that. And I was asked to attend in case he broke his neck as an orthopedic surgeon. And so I went to, and you'd have a race course with McPherson. I was in the crowd when he appeared. He came by helicopter, I think. And it was interesting. I was on one side, and as he emerged, the prince, I think he was dressed then as a jockey, but he was going to ride his mother's, like a grey mare, actually. And all the faces, all these oval, pale faces, looking towards him. And I realized then, in fact, what it must be like to grow up with all these faces looking at you and thinking you were something special as well. It is an extremely abnormal upbringing.
Yeah, it is.
Worse than the kibbutzim.
Well, I was
in
Salisbury in 1992, I think it was, possibly 91, 92, I'm pretty sure, for something called the Symphony for the Spire, for the Salisbury Cathedral,
which was
a massive concert with Placido Domingo, Pavarotti, and Phil Collins, you know. But anyway, the point was that there was a massive crowd. They'd put all these seats in the cathedral close on the grass there, and a big stage. And then the helicopter arrived. I suppose it would have been about 6:30 in the evening, something like that. And out of the helicopter, King Charles came down the steps on his own, and everyone was looking at each other. Well, where's Diana? Where's Diana? And so there was this sort of muted response as Charles went down, sort of shaking hands of members of the public who were by the railings. And must have been a good 5 minutes later, into the doorway of the helicopter steps Diana. She's there, but she's waited a long time. And anyway, when she was noticed by the crowd, the whole crowd went absolutely wild, cheering. And where there'd been no real response for the king at all, well, who's now the king at all.
You spur two thoughts. My reason why I thought it was inappropriate he should be a king is that he committed adultery from an early time of his marriage to Princess Diana.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is, we should want role models. That's not my role model. And the second thing you mentioned is sort of the cathedral. Don't forget that they played the organ in the cathedral, Salisbury Cathedral, whilst the people lined up to be jabbed in the cathedral.
Ugh.
What about that?
Well, it's very,
that is
very
the
sad.
Cult, the death cult in action.
But let me finish, because when Dinah appeared in the doorway of the helicopter and the crowd roared her name and started cheering, if looks could kill, he looked round at her, and because he'd had such a, you know, no response really, you know, from the crowd, a few murmurs, and oh, here's Charles, where, and everyone wanted Dinah, nobody really was interested in him, and when he looked round at her, it was obvious that he was really, really angry with the fact that she had garnered so much sympathy.
I read her last speech before she was assassinated, and it was about, anti-personnel mines, I suppose, in Angola then, but it's excellent English, obviously she might have been helped in that. But she obviously was a good-hearted woman.
Mm.
Tony?
Yeah, let me say my final thing about this, because I think we need to get to grips with the relationship of Diana and Charles particularly, and also the fact that, you know, with Dodie, she had chosen the person who was the biggest potential thorn in the side of the entire British establishment and the royal family. This is not known by many people, but the Queen refused to attend the wedding of Charles and Camilla. You were talking about adultery. And that's why, because the law says in this country that the King could not remarry if he had been the adulterer, and that's the law, and that's why the Queen, advised by the Archbishop of Canterbury, did not attend the wedding of Charles and Camilla, because she did not sanctify it herself.
Who was the Archbishop then?
It was before the time of Welby. No, I think
Williams.
I think so. But anyway, the point is that there was all sorts of fuss at the time, saying, well, no, he can't remarry, he's not allowed to. And of course, the Queen wanted Camilla to be called the Queen Consort, and she never really approved of that marriage at all, because she thought it was kind of bringing the country and the law into disrepute. It's basically only a law...
She was right, wasn't she?
Yeah, a lawless king. That's what we're dealing with, I think.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's what I feel, too.
Anyway, David, what's your website, please, for people who want to follow it and have a look?
D Halpin, DHALPIN .infoaction, INFOACTION .org.uk. If you click on the butterfly, there's a lovely garden here.
Yeah.
5-minute video. And there's a lot in it. Palestine, Kelly, NHS, and currently the continuum of fascism. And don't forget, Hiroshima, August the 6th, 1945. The London Conference to set up the Nuremberg trials, August the 6th, 1945. Nagasaki, August the 9th, 1945. So in between two holocausts, with the most terrible later effects, radiation sickness over 3 weeks or so, and later all sorts of cancers. In between two holocausts, the French, the Americans, the British, and I think the Russians, sat down to organize the Nuremberg trials between two holocausts. That underlines the continuum of fascism. And that's why you write about Bormann.
Mm.
All the best, Tony.
Okay, David Halpin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.